The following program is an MLWRadio.com production.
It's 4th of July week, at least. We're doing this on the 4th of July, so if anything's happened in the last couple of days, we don't talk about it. It's because it hadn't happened yet. But today, a big star is coming to MLW Radio, and upgrades are coming to the Jim Cornette Experience. Some people continue not to understand the words that are coming out of my mouth, and we will talk to our special guest, former NWA World Champion, current UFC Hall of Famer, and now published author, Dan the Beast Severn. And now here's a man who is possibly not published, but has certainly authored numerous publications for, I'm sure, left-wing liberal causes. My co-host, Mr. Co-host to you, the great Brian Last.
My grandparents loved Nixon. I feel like I need to throw that in there always. My grandparents loved Nixon. My grandfather thought he was great for business.
That also now may be the best opening line in the week of podcasting. My grandfather parents loved Nixon. Well, you've heard the big news. The big announcement was made by MLW Radio this past week. We're having company here on the podcasting block. Woo, Wednesday with the Nate. You've heard about this. You've read about this. Obviously, it's been all over the news. They even got skywriting and blimps involved.
That's right. The Nature Goy coming to MLW.
That's a full-throated endorsement. See, now his last is hot because he thinks we're going to lose our position as the runaway, far and away, highest-rated program on MLW Radio. I feel that competition is going to be good for the whole network, as they say here, and I think it's going to be a positive thing, especially when we beat the Nate because of our quality of content and the loyalty of the cult of Cornette. But no, basically, Court Bauer announced it. It gave him a way to look like Dana White this past week. He announced that the Ric Flair show had premiered, as a matter of fact, this week, hopefully, as we speak, and will be airing each and every Wednesday on MLW Radio. You can subscribe to Rick's show, the Ric Flair show, with co-host Conrad Thompson, who operates that exclusive resort down in Huntsville, the Conradison. But you can subscribe to his show by going to MLWRadio.com or searching for the Ric Flair show on iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn. Don't miss out on Wednesdays. And it's going to be, actually, when you think about it, it's going to be a perfect lead-in to what is ours, Threatening Thursday, then, with terroristic Threatening Thursday with Jim Cornette. So Nate is going to open the week for us there, and then it takes us a turn toward the more sour and bitter. And here the second thing is, I talked about improvements or upgrades to the experience. Things are changing with the way that you folks will have your experience delivered to you. Now, if you like your experience doctor, you can keep him. You know I don't understand this stuff, Brian. The technical side and all this iTunes stuff is totally over. I wouldn't know an iTunes if you held a gun to me, right? You understand all this stuff, but you know I don't.
I understand this stuff, and I certainly understand that you don't understand this stuff. Absolutely. Yes.
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to impart the information that Court Bauer, the major domo of MLW Radio, has given me, and then if I start interpreting it wrong, you're going to back me up and explain to the folks what the fuck's really going on. But if you want to keep listening to the Jim Cornette Experience, you may have to take action very soon, because we talked about the numbers getting so big, and actually we've exploded in 2016. Many people, chief among them, my co-host, the great Brian Last, say that it's because of his joining the show here. But last year in 2015, we went over 1 million downloads for the year by like the first part of November. This year, we're going to do that in August, if not sooner, with the numbers that we're doing. And so a lot of people ask, can we get on the iTunes and Stitcher thing and get our own feed and all this stuff? That's the emails that I've been seeing. You've seen some of those yourself. You could vouch for this. Yes, you saw
those. I can vouch for this.
You've never met me before. We've never met. Fuck, I knew I was going to get tickled on this thing. No, by popular demand, Court says you can now get just the Jim Cornette Experience podcast feed by itself. You either go to mlwradio.com or you search for the Jim Cornette Experience on iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn to subscribe to the show. If you subscribe right away, you can start getting the experience delivered directly to your computer, smartphone, and tablets. It doesn't cost anything. This is a free subscription, like the other people subscribe, I guess, to things that they do with these Stitchers and things. But here's the deal. Starting July 28th, our new podcast feed that I just mentioned and MLWRadio.com will be the only way you're going to be able to hear the experience. The show will not be available any longer on the main MLW radio feed that you've been subscribing to. Have I told people that? Would people who have done that type of thing recognize the words that had just come out of my mouth?
Somewhat. I feel like you don't plug the iTunes as much as you have MLWRadio.com, so I think this is a good way of saying you can now subscribe on iTunes and not have your iTunes feed filled up with a bunch of shows you don't want. You can subscribe to just the Jim Cornette Experience for the first time. Finally, something that should have been done a while ago, it's finally happening.
Well, there you go. And now you're going to get a seat with the network, as they say. Well, don't miss out. Subscribe right now by going to MLWRadio.com or plugging Jim Cornette Experience into the search box on iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn. You've got just 3 weeks before we make this move permanently to the new feed, so you can sign up, and it's free and all that stuff, but you got to sign up, or somehow, some way, you might stop getting these shows delivered to whatever the fuck you listen to this on, however you're doing it. And so we are anxious and excited about this new turn this new turn for the worse.
You do not want to miss Threatening Thursday. Sign up now.
No, you don't. And on the Twitter thing, the big controversy, and we wanted to just mention it. Apparently, not only we thought last week, and actually I fell for it, Mick. Thank you, Mick, because you vouched for him. He's already admitted he fucked up. And he was sorry, but thanks, Mick, because Mick vouched for but a lot of people did. A lot of people were taken in by this a fake Bobby Heenan Twitter account. And come to find out that not only is that account now been proven to be a fake, but the one that we thought was his wife that had gotten, you know, a couple thousand followers, Cindy, we thought, because it's been around for a while, that one's fake too, by the same person. I mean, the parodies are one thing, and some of them are witty, and some of them do clog up my Twitter machine, to be quite honest with you. Jesus H. Christ, why do you have to pretend to be somebody to the point where you're fooling their friends, especially somebody like Bobby, who's not been able to communicate with his fans recently for obvious health reasons, and to do something like that is what I do. So they've taken it down.
That's the saddest part, Jimmy.
But they got verified in a fucking. But no, here's the thing. I'll tell you. Here's the rib. They got people were on the Twitter machine saying, "Well, it took you 2 years to get verified, and it only took this fake guy a week." So that's bullshit. This, actually, the same guy that got me verified got that one verified because of all the WWF guys vouching for him.
It all started with Mick Foley.
He did it for free because he wanted to do something for Bobby Heenan. They fucked him too. He was trying to do something for poor Bobby Heenan, to help him out, and the guy fucked him too. So the same guy that verified me for, so don't take it out on that guy, folks, because he fell for it the same reason I did. I was like, oh God, and I was retweeting shit, right?
Well, Jimmy, that's the saddest thing is what you hit on before. Bobby is unable to communicate due to all of his various medical issues, and you would think that Bobby Heenan, the king of the one-liners, still as sharp as ever. Twitter's actually a perfect forum for him. The firm to go on there and deliver, you know, one-liners and communicate with his fans. It actually is a great place for him to be. It's just unfortunate that it was an imposter. And because of all this, I don't know if Bobby ever actually will go on Twitter.
Well, I don't. Let me just say this also. I'm just reading his mind now because I've never actually asked, but I have a feeling it's just because it's another thing that he'd, like me, he'd have to have his wife help him do because. He can't figure it out. He told me one time, when we were in New Jersey for a Ring of Honor show, it was like 10 years ago. He's the same way I am. He had the phone that he didn't really know how to use, and he didn't want to fucking text. And, his wife would call him, and basically, that's it. And he said he had just gotten rid of the one flip phone where you couldn't see the number. You had to open it up to see the number that was calling. But if you open it, you've answered it automatically. Remember those? He would try to pry it open a little bit and peek and see if he could see the number without answering it. And he said, yeah, I'm the brain, right? What the fuck? I don't think Bobby wants to get involved in any of that technological bullshit, to be quite honest with you. I may be completely wrong, but it would just strike me if he was like, then I'll just tell Cindy to type something and whatever. So you never know, but that may be it. But the Twitter has fired me up just real, real briefly, because we got a great show. We're going to talk to Dan Severn, who's a UFC Hall of Famer, and get a little perspective on a business we don't normally talk about with somebody that's been involved in it at such a high level. But, Brian, why don't people sometimes, what is the matter with the cognitive ability of the people who sometimes just don't get it? You know those people. They're out there. They just don't get it. Whatever it may be, in whatever field that you may be in, there's some people that just don't get it. But a lot of these people just don't get anything. We had a very strong reaction to last week's show. It was all over Twitter, all over the internet, et cetera, et cetera. And we know that it's like when I blister the gun nuts or the comedy wrestling fans, the reaction is overwhelmingly positive amongst educated folks who can spell. And the small, minuscule amount of people who disagree with me use random capitalization, occasional punctuation, are in serious need of a Webster's Dictionary and a book of synonyms and antonyms. And their letters are the internet equivalent of being put together like a ransom note. Some of those people just don't get it. But in this case, our guest, we had a guest of honor on last week's show, where really the whole point was to tell people about the quality of his existence on this earth. The idiot's response himself, incredibly enough, I would have never guessed this, was the stupidest one of anybody's. And I just want to take the time just a minute before we get to other business. It's not going to take long. But I just wanted to explain this. Here's the whole thrust, and bear with me if I misspeak, Brian. Maybe you can help me convey the meaning of this better than I can verbally. The whole thrust of last week's show, the whole point of it, the whole topic of conversation overriding the whole thing, it being interspersed with moments of information, was that I hate this motherfucker so bad that I have dreams of murdering him, that I wake up in the night screaming his name, that the thought of being in the same place with him, of hearing his voice, of seeing his face, the whole idea of possibly being in his presence, leading me to not be able to trust myself, where I will physically assault him. Someone will be in need of doctor's aid, and the other one will be in need of legal aid. And that's why I've promised my wife, I've gone that far, that I would never be in the same place as this guy again, to avoid trouble for everybody. And you know what his response was? Say that to my face. And here's the best part. It's not even like the kids on the schoolyard, because that's the way he books. Like the kid on the schoolyard who pulls his pants down and shakes his pee-pee so people will look at him, right? That's his booking. But he actually, it's not to his face. It's say it to my face on Skype.
Because on your podcast.
Either one. He offered both. The idiot is so desperate for ratings or attention or to shaking his small pee-pee or whatever, or to make everything one of his shoot angles or whatever. His entire response was either for me to do his show or him to do this one, and we'll get this all settled. And we'll get this, like, people can't understand the amazing concept of good old-fashioned hatred, that it's not going to be settled. There's no talking something like this out. There is a complete disconnect in the two of us as fucking human beings on this planet from one pole to the other, there could be no one more diametrically opposite in any way, shape, or form, physically, mentally, emotionally. But I just want to clear. And then he got his water carriers and the fanboy flunkies that he gins up on the internet that follow him somehow may be convinced that I'm making it my business, that I somehow make money off knocking dickheads. So I just wanted to let everybody know, just a statement of clarification here. I make money off a variety of things, whether it be my books and merchandise or my appearances or my podcast or my comic book business or my goddamn writings or my whatever the fuck. But I do not make any money. Absolutely. Off knocking Vince Russo. Knocking asswipe is my hobby. I do it for free. Sometimes I spend money on it. It's like other people put together model ships. It relaxes me. So I want to assure everybody that there will never be a show, live, tape, audio, video, wrestling, cooking, 700 Club, whatever, wherever, with me appearing with, on with, or in conjunction to Vince Fuckface Russo. I just want to make that clear. It's not a thing about saying it to his face. I'm not doing anything behind his back. He can hear this all day long, and I'm fine with that. It is not anything about not wanting to air out grievances, because I believe I'm airing them just fine, but I'm not going to encourage or promote the idea of him making one more dime from this business that he has raped. I have already turned down offers totaling up well into five figures just on the ones that I asked about to do anything with him. And the only reason I asked then, when the people would hit me with this shit, I would say, and how much are you going to pay me? And they would tell me, and I say, you going to give him the same thing? And they'd say, yes. And I say, good. Then call him up and tell him how much money I just cost him when I turned that down. So no, there's not going to be any way in the world that this is going to happen. We're not going to be talking this out or having a big debate, but I assure you, I'm not talking behind his back. I'm fine with him hearing every bit of it. It's a service to him that I don't do it in person. And I just want to... Do you think they'll get that now, Brian? Do you think that is possibly, because that's, you know, that was his feeble response to try to get his water carriers to gin up that, oh, I'm ducking him. I'm ducking him. The whole thrust of the show was I'm performing a service to him physically by staying the fuck away from him.
Yeah. You know, it reminds me, there was a little thing when I first started as your co-host where someone had some rude things to say about me, and I let him know what I thought, and I think everyone remembers exactly how that turned out.
Exactly how that turned out. That escalated quickly also.
Well, I kind of feel, and most people do, that I kind of won that little battle, but the person I was speaking about issued this missive. And in each paragraph of the missive, it was like, I would be more than happy to come on the Jim Cornette Experience to talk about. It was all begging to come on and keep this going. And it was, I got the same feeling out of this. It's like, you didn't do this to have a back and forth. You did this to make your statement, and that was it. It wasn't like you were looking for
the
terms
of it. I did this to engage in my hobby. That makes me feel good. It relaxes me. Some people collect stamps. I collect instances where dumb fuck has done stupid shit. And I laugh at him for it, but I'm not interested in fucking having an ongoing fucking where he and his pittance of Twitter followers and his fucking negligible listeners can fucking further exacerbate his fucking burdensome existence on planet Earth. Anyway, now that we've done that, we got the Super Summer Sizzler Series tour, Brian, as you know, is hotter than ever, hotter than a firecracker. Because next week, while you're going apparently now to Hawaii for your vacation and staying at the fucking Zabada Waikiki Magnificent Zulu Resort and Casino, I'm going to be...
As long as it's not the Amazing Zulu, I'll be okay.
All right, well, there you go. I'll be about halfway there. I'll be in Oak City. we talked about it a couple weeks on a program ago with JR, but Saturday and Sunday, July 16 and 17, Oklahomania. Saturday in Shawnee at the Fire Lake Arena, Sunday at the Cox Convention Center in Oklahoma City, convention all day on Sunday and live matches that afternoon. Jim Ross, Sting, the Hardys, Jeff Jarrett, Jerry Lawler, MVP, Hacksaw Duggan, et cetera, et cetera. It's going to be the biggest independent wrestling event in 20 years since Mid-South Wrestling in Oklahoma City and Shawnee. that weekend. And by the way, folks, you can go to jimcornette.com for all this information. Friday and Saturday, July 29th and 30th, I'll be at Fandom Fest in Louisville at the Kentucky Fair and Exposition Center, along with Stan Lee. JC and Stan Lee will be right side by side signing autographs. His will cost more. Thursday through Sunday, we know August 4th through the 7th, the Charlotte Fan Fest, NWALegends.com, folks. Jim Ross ringside live on Thursday, followed by me, the Jim Cornette Experience, live at about midnight, because I do stay up late and tell ribald stories. Friday, the Hall of Heroes Banquet. There's going to be Q&As of the Ole Anderson roast on Sunday. You got to be there at Charlotte Fan Fest. It's the greatest weekend of the summer. And Saturday, August 27th, I'll be in Shenston, West Virginia at Gold Rush 3 for the APWA in the city of Shenston, along with the Rock and Roll Express, the Powers of Pain, and many, many more. And also, the Fall Brawl Tour begins on Friday, September 23rd, and Saturday, September 24th. We're going to be ringside an evening with Jim Ross and Jim Cornette. I'm trying to get that arranged alphabetically, so it's an evening with Jim Cornette and Jim Ross, but they were afraid it would negatively affect ticket sales. But that's at Jimmy's Famous Seafood in Baltimore on the 23rd, and then the 24th, MCW Pro Wrestling is presenting the tribute to the legends. The convention is 10 to 4. The bell time is 7:30. Jim Ross, myself, the Hart Foundation, Paul Orndorff, and more. MCWProWrestling.com is the place to go for that one. And I'm looking forward to being back in Baltimore, not only for Jimmy's Famous Seafood, but also because there may be some Italian food involved that weekend. I'm not sure, but it could happen. And also, I forgot, Kayfabe Commentaries, in addition to the new You Shoot with Swoggle, What is it? FKA, formerly known as Hornswoggle, but apparently he got hornswoggled in the legal issues. No, I met Swoggle, and he was a nice kid. While we were shooting that weekend in Monroe, New Jersey, and already they've whipped this out. Mine, they just sit on forever, but they whipped this right out. No, he's hot right now. Swoggle U Shoot, and this is different than a lot of the normal U Shoots, because in normal U Shoots, the fans send in the questions, but in this case, some of the boys got together and apparently decided to rib young Swoggle, and a bunch of the boys have sent in a bunch of questions. So anyway, you shoot games, all kinds of good stuff on the new Swoggle You Shoot at shootinterviews.com. And don't forget the newest Back to the Territories on the WWA, the World Wrestling Association in Indianapolis, of Dick the Bruiser with Baron Von Raschke. And that is all the people need to know, is coming out in the next couple weeks. And there's going to be some incredible historic B-roll and documents and memorabilia, all kinds of cool stuff on this release. So shootinterviews.com is the place to go for everything that you need to know. See, I just did it. Remind me to tell Sean Oliver. I just did their next slogan for him. Right there it was.
I'll remind you, rhyming Jimmy Cornette.
I just come up with this brilliance off the top of my head. So there it is, shootinterviews.com, shootinterviews.com. And you've got a show, a little show you like to call The Mothership.
The Mothership, the best wrestling podcast on the planet today, the 605 Super Podcast. You know, I don't think we mentioned it last week on the show, Jimmy, but you were actually on. You watched a classic squash match, jobber match, whatever people want to call it, between Rip Hawk and this guy, Billy Jackson, who takes the most ridiculous bumps, you know, this side of Marion Crumley. Everything he does, he just throws himself back and goes down like he was shot.
Wait, you just threw that Marion Crumley in like, oh, everybody's going to know that. I remember Marion Crumley, and oh, that's a classic reference.
Yeah, some people will know. Some people will get that. It was a very popular match when I used to have tape parties everywhere I went. But with the audio's up on last week's show, you could hear Jim watching this match, as well as some stories about the Midnight Express dealing with job guys. And actually, a bunch of people have gotten in touch with me, Jim. The match you were talking about was from March of 1987. It was Bobby Eaton against a jobber who froze.
Yes.
Stopped cooperating in the middle of the match because he just couldn't deal with it. He couldn't deal with being on national television and in front of actual people. wrestling.
And it's the goddamn, I think it was, they said, it was, I saw it on Twitter, March 21st or whatever they said it was. And it, that was the week that, that Dennis had disappeared. And before we got Stan, Bobby was in a single match. And yeah, that guy just, he froze the fuck up and would, and he wasn't resisting. He just wasn't doing anything. It was like a, literally a fucking dead body. And Bobby had to figure out a way to put himself in holds and shit and do moves. And oh my God, it was, the guy was just overwhelmed. He had a mental short circuit.
Yeah. And for those of you who want to see that, it's on the WWE Network. It is the March 21st, 1987 episode of World Championship Wrestling. Bobby Eaton against Alan Fox. So you can check that out. And if you want to see Jim Cornette doing commentary over Rip Hawk versus Billy Jackson, that's on YouTube. Just put Jim Cornette, Billy Jackson, or Jim Cornette, Rip Hawk in the search engine, and boom, it'll pop up just like that. Of course, you can listen to it on last week's Super Podcast. This week's Super Podcast, Jim, an old friend of mine, an old friend of yours who hasn't been heard from in a long time, is going to be on the show. Don Leibel, long time.
Oh my God! I thought you were going to say somebody that's been kidnapped or hasn't been heard somewhere has suddenly been released. But no, Donnie Leibel's one, an old member of the WFIA, the Wrestling Fans International Association, a very good close personal friend of mine. Yeah. And Mean Jeans. Yes,
we have someone no one's heard from a while on the show this week. Andre the Giant on the show this week. No one's heard from him for 25 years.
Do you know what I would say to Andre the Giant if he were standing in front of me right here, right now?
Well, I think I do.
I'd say, Andre, what are you doing here? You've been dead for 20 years. That's a Dutch Mantel joke.
Yeah, I remember Dutch doing that on Memphis TV. That, like, you know what I would like to say to my grandmother right now if she was here? Grandma, what are you doing here? You've been dead for 20 years.
Finish your plug and we don't even charge you for it, so we can get Dan Severn on.
Well, this week on the show, Don Leibel, as Jimmy said, he was involved with the fan club scene in the 70s. I think he met Jimmy for the first time in Knoxville in 78 at the WFIA convention. Jim Cornette was there. Brian Hildebrand was there. Eddie Gilbert was there. A lot of people who got involved in the wrestling business were involved with the WFIA. But from there, he became a photographer and a writer. He's still a sports writer today in upstate New York. And Don walked away from wrestling, and we get that story about exactly what happened. And it is one of the craziest stories you will ever hear. It is, to summarize it without giving away too much, Donnie being held captive by an ECW wrestler, and it got to the point where it made him decide to walk away from the wrestling business, a business he had been involved in for close to 40 years and a business he had loved. And
wait a minute, then basically there was a hostage situation involved. What the I somehow precognitively I divined the answer without knowing the content of the situation.
You didn't know the content of the situation, but you know the people involved in the situation. And that story will be on the Super Podcast this week, as well as Donnie's stories of working for the magazines. Which magazines ripped off photographers and writers? Which ones didn't? Why is George Napolitano not as heralded as some other people in the magazine world? You get Donnie's opinions and thoughts on all of this, and some run-ins with people like Lou Sahadi and various other people, Bill Apter, and that's on this week's episode of the 605 Super Podcast at 605pod.com. It's available on iTunes, just like the Jim Cornette
script. For fuck's sake, everything's available. My home movies from when I was a kid, apparently, are on iTunes now. What is with this fucking I've got to check this fucking iTunes thing out.
You got to buy some Apple stock like I did.
Well, it's getting too big for its fucking britches. I need to investigate that. All right. Anyway, let's go now to the wilds of Coldwater, Michigan. Let's get Dan the Beast Severn on the phone.
Well, Jimmy, it looks like we have Dan Severn set up here on the show. So the beast is unleashed here on the Point Experience.
And you almost got through that without fumble mouthing it. Ladies and gentlemen, he is a former NWA World Champion. As we mentioned, he's a UFC Hall of Famer, Triple Crown winner. He's done it all, but most recently, he is a published author and joining the literary set with his book. It's a biography, The Realest Guy in the Room. It's Dan the Beast Severn. Dan, thank you very much for being on The Experience today.
Well, Jim, thanks for having me.
You know, I how did the book? We're gonna go back into your career a little bit, but just how did the idea for the book finally come about? And did Ian Douglas is your co-author? Did he just kind of browbeat you about it, or did you decide it was time? Because sometimes it takes a while to get up off that project and actually do something about it.
Well, I'll say combination of the both. The thing there, Jim, I've actually been writing the book for probably I'll say close to two decades. The problem is I had way too much content. When I say that I have a folder and I have well over 1,000 pages, I mean I have well over 1,000 pages. But on a page, there might be just, there'll be like half a dozen different little mini paragraphs, four or five sentences. And give you an example. One little example would be like saying, Leipzig, East Germany. Russian negotiations, lots of vodka. And those, well, I know the vodka thing kind of kicks in there, but those three or four lines represents probably a 15 to 20 page story for me. Well, first off, there isn't an East Germany anymore. And they let people know that I've been around a long time, and one of the greatest testimonials to an athlete is that test of time. So when I go on timetables alone, I started my journey in amateur wrestling in 1969. By 1976, I'm the number one recruit in the United States to go out to college at my weight class. Then jump forward another 20 years. By 1996, I'm the number one cage fighter in the world. You know, jump into the school up to 2016, I was yet set to climb into the cage one more time to do a match with the Ken Shamrock that he somehow slipperily bowed out of. So when you look at, well, I just spanned it four decades. There just now. I know that I will go into my fifth decade of competition. So I always tell people I've been around for a long time. I've been terrorizing athletes for a long time. I've been accused of, it's no way it's Dan Severn. It's got to be the son of Dan Severn. To the point that, somehow I have clones, or I should be, I'm slapping mustaches on different people and sending them out there and just calling them Dan Severn.
Well, you know, you know what it is. It's that awful portrait of you that you keep locked away in the attic with the worms crawling out of your skin and everything. No, I can attest, and we'll talk about it here a little later. I can attest to the fact I saw you blow up about four 25-year-olds, one right after another, just a couple of years ago at workouts at your camp there in Coldwater. But and we're also going to talk about how the Severn Shamrock's third encounter on pay-per-view has become kind of like the Loch Ness Monster. People have seen it, wanted to find it, but they've never been able to quite get their hands on it. But you mentioned you started wrestling so long ago, and reading the book, because I'd been to Coldwater and I'd seen, you know, your whole workout facility there is lined a shelf all the way around the place. And I mean, I don't know how many thousand square feet that is. And every single inch of space is taken up by a trophy or a medal or a plaque or an award or something that you've won in legitimate competition of one kind or another. I used to say it when I was lucky enough to manage you, one of the most decorated amateur and professional wrestler athletes that the United States has ever produced. But as your book says, when you started wrestling in middle school, it was a rocky introduction to wrestling, especially when you'd seen wrestling on TV. Sheik and Bobo Brazil at the Cobo Arena was your frame of reference of wrestling on TV. And then you didn't immediately meet with success in grade school when you started competing.
Yep. No, exactly. I was, you know, like any other kid, I was just kind of getting my feet wet at the different types of sports. I started off being a basketball player. I kept thinking, Wilt Chamberlain was one of the big stars at that time. I kept thinking, oh, I want to be just like Wilt the Silt. I'm going to do this overhook type of a basket type thing. No, the thing is, well, I'm not 7 foot tall, and I'm uncoordinated in the whole nine yards. So I just sat on the bench. You know, a lot of times, but, just kind of fast forward, there just happened to be a big flu epidemic that took place, and a number of my friends that were on the wrestling team, they're like, hey, Dan, would you come in and fill in a weight class tonight? Otherwise, we'll have to forfeit it.
Well,
I'm a strong young firm boy. I'm thinking, oh, I know a thing or two about wrestling right there. You know, I wrestled twice at gym. I got tossed in my back and got pinned both times, so it's not like I exactly set the world on fire when I first began out, because that's why I always tell people, they only hear about the success. They don't realize there's a lot of hard work that goes into this, and you aren't going to have success usually in the beginning, or you'll have some setbacks during the course of your career. You'll have to overcome injuries and how many athletes are willing to even sacrifice all the time away of traveling off to this competition, time away to train? There's so many moving parts that have to come together in order to be successful at,
That's why I think it's just incredible. For one thing, it's hilarious that basically a flu epidemic, everybody's wiped out on the team. Yeah, well, you severed it. Like, that's the way that you break in.
I wasn't exactly called the go-to guy. It's like, well, he's one of the last standing survivors, so let's throw him in.
Well, and it's like the you know, the star is six, and now the understudy gets a chance and becomes, you know, the star of Broadway or whatever. But in all seriousness, by the time you finished high school, you'd won the national championship in high school freestyle and Greco-Roman in 76, and you go to Arizona State. And you continued to excel until almost every year, somewhere or another, you'd have an injury or some issue as you were about to win a championship or about to go undefeated.
Well, that would say probably my darkest period for me in competition wise was my college aspect. By 1976, you can go over that timetable. By 1976, to be the number one recruited, I was at the 185-pound weight class. I always tell people, if and when I weighed 185 pounds, because I always said that I played football at 225 pounds. I was a three-sport athlete in high school, played football in the fall, wrestled throughout the winter months, and I was on the track team. I ran the hurdles, a 440-yard dash. I did the long jumping. But the track coach was just so frustrated with me because I did good in the shot put. I did good in the long jump in it. But he knew that if there was a Saturday track meet and there was a Saturday wrestling meet, he would never see me at the track meet. And he knew that. I said that I was out for the track team just to keep my cardiovascular training, and I would compete as much as I possibly could when it did not interrupt with my wrestling. Because I invested a lot of time in my wrestling for a couple of different reasons. First off, I have seven other brothers and sisters. I'm second on the totem pole. I would have never in my mind would I have ever thought of asking my parents for money to go to college. And when I was a freshman in high school, a couple of my friends had older brothers, and they went into the military for 4 years, and then they came out and went to college on a GI Bill. I thought, wow, that sounds like a great idea. That's probably what I'll do. Upon high school graduation, I'll go in the military, give them 4 years, come back out, go on a GI Bill. Well, by my sophomore year, I was just starting to gather a little bit of attention from some college coaches. So I really thought, man, this might be a new route for me now. How can I draw more attention to myself? So during my junior year, one of the biggest things I did was, in one day, I went and I entered into my age bracket, which was junior, 18 years and younger. I went three weight classes, 198, 220, and heavyweight. Most gymnasium most gymnasium floors are only capable of holding three mats. So to give you an idea, I could be wrestling on mat number one. They could be calling me on deck on mat number two, and in the hole on mat number three. But what it means is the moment that they say, you must report to mat number two, the clock would start. I would have 5 minutes, and if I could not show up within that five-minute range, I would be automatically disqualified. So I would be on mat number one, and they would be saying, the answer must report to mat number two, and I would be on deck on mat number three. So I have to finish my guy up on mat number one. As I'm walking towards mat number two, I'm wiping out the towels, take a shot of water, just to walk right out of the mat, and knowing that I would be doing boom, 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 boom. Now, I'm doing one age group at 190, I'm doing one age group called the junior age group, 198, 220 heavyweight. Then I entered into the next age group bracket, which is open. Anything over 18 years of age. So now I'm going against college guys. I'm going against coaches. Three weight classes, 190, 220 heavyweight. So with one day, two age groups, six weight classes, 17 matches later, I walk out of that gymnasium with six gold medals, and I had people talking. Because they're like, what a machine to go from. And literally, I pinned basically everybody. And they're like, it is irregardless.
That's also, so, you just invented a great wrestling gimmick match. Three rings side by side, and the guy got bang, 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 bang. But no, as a matter of fact, you almost had a wrestling gimmick match in your senior year at heavyweight, you were unpinned, right? And then going into, I guess, what was in the NCAA tournament, you were like,
oh,
third.
Oh, yeah, place. Dr. Death, Steve Williams, you betcha.
What was Doc like from somebody who this is the first time that I've actually spoken to, I think, someone who wrestled Doc. Well, obviously, we've spoken before, but not about this. But who wrestled Dr. Death, Steve Williams, in the NCAA tournament, and what a moose he was. What was it like wrestling Doc? I think you were probably more technical.
The first time I seen him, he actually even when he was in college, he was using the moniker of Dr. Death Steve Williams. And here he is. He's a football player and a wrestler at Oklahoma University. So here, Arizona State University is at Oklahoma University, and we're wrestling him in a dual meet. And he's going out there on the heavyweight weight class. And it was kind of funny because he's walking out. He's in front of his home crowd, and his own home crowd is heeling on him. They're booing him. And he loved it. He was blowing them kisses and stuff like this. I'm thinking, this guy was a worker way back then. It was unbelievable. But, I mean, you know, just like you said, a very powerful lot of moxie to him, you know.
Yeah. And actually, he re-aggravated a neck injury that you'd had your junior year, and that's when he whacked you on the head there. That's what put you down. He advanced.
I had not been pinned my entire college career. So my very last match of my college career, I'm wrestling Dr. Death Steve Williams for third and fourth place. I shoot in on the way he sprawls, whatever, and basically hits me. It felt like a lightning bolt ran down my entire spine. I felt like I was paralyzed. He just, like a football player, he ran over me, and I just laid there, and he pinned me. And that was it. I'm thinking to myself, I have to pin in a four-year career, and the last match of my career, I get pinned. I'm like going, wow.
Well,
but then once again, I did not never would imagine that he was going to go on to do his professional wrestling, something like this, to see him again years later as a performer, you know, doing what he was doing in Japan, what he was doing around the United States. So it was kind of good to see, once again, just someone from days gone by.
And the thing is, you were the most unlucky person that he ever partially paralyzed with a stinger, because you didn't at least get to get drunk first. Almost everybody else, he would have done that too, would have been in a bar. They would have already been drunk by the time it is.
Well, I was probably still so blue afterwards. I probably did afterwards.
Hey, let me, Dan, even more broadly than your amateur career, you kept wrestling at a high level as an amateur, and you've competed across the spectrum. That's one thing I think is so interesting and details in the book, that at the same time as you had competed amateur wrestling, you also got in on the early days of the Ultimate Fighting Championship, and you also wrestled in Japan for whether it be pro wrestling groups or shoot groups, and you studied and trained in pro wrestling and became the NWA champion. So you were doing all this simultaneously. You never really stuck to one genre. I think that's why a lot of people don't realize how at each field, how high you excelled. But tell me a couple of stories that are in the book, just a couple of that, about your early impressions of the UFC when you heard about this brand new thing they were going to do called mixed martial arts and ultimate fighting.
Well, I'll touch on a couple of the notes that brought out there. The schedule that I was keeping at the time was incredible. I was still doing amateur wrestling. I was still trying to make a 1992 Olympic team. And, you know, that's all at the same time, and as of the 1992 Olympics, a new ruling came down from the United States Olympic Committee that allowed athletes to be both amateur and professional simultaneously, as long as you were involved in a high school athletic program or a collegiate program. You used to be governed by NCAA rules or your high school athletic association rules. Well, I was well past my collegiate eligibility, so I could have my cake and eat it too. I could be a professional wrestler, but then I could also pursue Olympic teams and world teams and things of that nature.
When they did that change, that's why now all the big NBA players start saying NWA. All the big NBA players can play on the basketball team, where before that ruling, it was limited only to collegiate players and under. Because they all on the NBA.
When the Dream Team went out there, and a lot of people were up in arms because the United States finally put the Dream Team of athletes. So, yeah, it should definitely change the Olympic Games for what it is. But a lot of cool things can happen. I jumped into it, kind of later in life, because the reality is I kept thinking I jumped in professional sports. I kept thinking this might be my only opportunity to ever live a lifestyle of a professional athlete. And, so here I am traveling from Coldwater, Michigan over to Lima, Ohio, training professional wrestling with Al Snow, Body Slammers Gym. And, I'm older than doing that. Didn't have that many matches underneath my belt. Used my real name, used my real amateur credentials. Happened to be on a show that Candy Devine was on, and Elle basically had talked to Candy about, she was seeing Tom Burton at the time, and he was basically helping out with this UWF organization out of Japan. So she asked me if my credentials were legit, and I said they were, and I gave her one of my athletic resumes, a business card. 3 days later, I get a phone call from Tom Burton. 10 days later, I'm down in Nashville, Tennessee for a tryout. 30 days later, I'm in Tokyo, Japan. Don't have a clue as to what I'm doing. All I know is my Asian opponent kicked me half a dozen times really, really hard. And I'm not thinking, forget this. I closed the distance. I grabbed him. I just literally started this aerial launching him all over the place, dismantling him. The crowd goes bazonkers. And the interpreter says, Don Saban, you will become superstar in Japan. I'm thinking, I don't know about being a superstar. I'm just not going to let someone just tee off on me like that. And that was kind of my introduction. It just, I was, in a lot of ways, they weren't smarting me up there either, because that was a company that part of the show was a legit shoot, and then the rest of the show was all works.
Well, that's like when I got into business, Bill Dundee always used to say about me when I was in Memphis the first year and didn't know anything, don't smarten Cornette up, it'll kill his gimmick. You went out there, and you got over by being a dominant American that just suplexed the shit out of your opponent and flattened him. And imagine that. Imagine who would think something like that would get over? As simple as that. A guy that's a dominant badass that suplexed a guy out of his boots and beats him and gets over.
The cool part of being there was, meeting Lou Thesz for the first time, meeting Billy Robinson for the first time. So, again, I'm meeting, history. And actually having both men, first time I met Lou, and he's kind of watching it like this. He says, I really like the way that you work your mechanics and stuff like that. I thanked him very much. I said, well, that's my life has been amateur wrestling and knowing how to do the least amount of work and get the maximum results out of techniques, because cardiovascular, you want to be able to keep your cardiovascular. So it was great to get.
Hey, what about Robinson? What about, did you get a chance to wrestle him a little bit or work out with him, or would just?
I'd say he was kind of the winding down portion of his life. You could simply tell that just watching him walk, he was in pain. And, but he was a great person to sit there and talk to. And he would show a couple little techniques, just like Lou would show a couple little things right there. And I kept thinking, wow, I'm here with history, and I get a chance to talk to them and pick their brains and things of that nature. Something.
Isn't it amazing that Billy Robinson ended up being more important to and training more people for the MMA world than for professional wrestling? When you think about it, that's kind of what he was doing 50 years ago. People just didn't have a name for it yet. The matches that you had in the UFC, or the fights, I should say, either way, whether it be with Gracie or the two with Ken or Tank Abbott, everybody loves Tank Abbott stories. But if you have one, feel free. But when you are in the beginning stages of a sport like that, and it's kind of being invented as you go along, and you've got those outsized personalities, you were kind of like the constant guy that was a little bit more level-headed, but you had interaction with all those guys in the early days, and the pay-per-views were selling.
The give you a couple ideas right there. When I first showed up at my very first UFC number 4, you know, they're basically, you know, again, to give some of your listeners a little bit of the history there, it wasn't a weigh-in because there was no weight classes. Again, you know, that what mixed martial arts today, mixed martial arts has approximately 47 rules. Part of that 47 rules is weight classes, time periods known as rounds, athletes wear gloves, and you fight one opponent in a given evening. Back in that NHB, no holds barred era, there were only two rules you had to abide by. That being, do not bite your opponent, do not stick fingers in your eye socket, otherwise known as no eye gouging. End of the rules, Jim. So let your imagination go wild of all the things you could do to another human being, and you were good to go, and it was being done at different times. Bare knuckled, no weight classes. There was one of the biggest weight differences was over 400 pounds, and it was an 8-man tournament. So in the same 2 hour that still plays to this day, where guys are just facing one opponent, you had to face three opponents. So at this Friday night press conference, you would have these 8 men that would be sitting up there, and then you'd have the MC up there that would basically would say, you know, would Hoist Gracie please stand on up? Hoist Gracie is this tall. He weighs this much. His athletic background, and basically tell you, you know, present jiu-jitsu, blah, blah, blah. Okay, sit down. Next guy, stand up, you know, Ken Shamrock, the Dan Severn. And then once they basically kind of announced the different athletes, they would pull out this bingo ball style machine that had 8 balls, and each ball had a name on it. So they spin around, whatever first ball came out, okay, Hoist Gracie, you're number 1. Spin again, okay, Ken Shamrock, you're number 2. So first, you found out less than 24 hours before you climb in the cage who your first opponent was. And it was kind of funny because out of these 8 men that are up there, I'm the only guy that shows up wearing a sports jacket and a tie. And I look like some sports agent or an insurance agent, wearing tank tops, muscle garb, things of this nature, just looking intimidated. And here I'm sitting up there looking like, you know, Clark Kent is, you know, in the words of Jim Brown. But that
you look like you came in to be their business manager instead of to win the tournament.
Exactly, but I'd already worked at Arizona State and Michigan State, so typical attire was a sports jacket and a tie, and that's what I showed up with. You know, even when I tried out for the UWFI organization, when they picked me up, here I have my, because it was just going to be just a one-day type trial when I went down to Nashville. So as I arrived there, I walk in, I've got a sports jacket on, a tie, I have my briefcase, and I have my duffel bag. It was like, I'm here, I'm a businessman, and they had like these half dozen other guys that were over there all warming up. And they looked like your standard professional wrestler from that era. They almost all had blonde hair. They were jacked to the gills with muscles and stuff like that. And they're going through the routine, and I'm basically by myself. I'm just warm up, stretching out. And they said, well, when you're ready, come on over. And I said, well, I'm ready, and walks over. They said, will you please demonstrate this, demonstrate that. So I'm demonstrating all these various techniques, and they're like, is there anything else you want me to demonstrate? They asked me, is there anything else I'd demonstrate? I go, well, I can show you a couple of these and that. I did that. We went and had lunch. And then they showed us a videotape of what a live UWFI competition looked like. And they said that there's only one contract being offered. So as we go back to the gym that afternoon, I dismantled the other 7 men and walked away from the contract.
You know, and here, and we might jump out of order a little bit here, but this is what, when people have a visual image of a guy named Dan the Beast Severn, you think you look like Ox Baker with the demonic eyebrows and the bald head and the creases, the scars and everything, and you come in, but here's, and I'm sorry, I love the line. I don't know if he meant it in all good fun, but when Tank Abbott said fighting you was like being prison raped by Freddie Mercury, You have a very professional demeanor. You're well dressed, but then suddenly you just go crazy and stretch or beat or pound or submit whoever you're across the ring or cage with. into submission some kind of way, or just hang on top of them until they fucking pass out from oxygen deprivation. That's hence the title, Realest Guy in the Room. Do you think that's why I was so frustrated with the way that you were presented in the WWF as one of the boys, as just another wrestler on the roster within a couple of weeks? They started good. We can talk about that. But then within a couple of weeks, it was, they didn't understand, even though the UFC was selling in six figures of pay-per-views at that time during the first wave before John McCain couldn't keep his nose out of other people's business. The most dominant guy or the champion or the most qualified guy from that sport comes in. They certainly didn't treat Mike Tyson like that. And granted, maybe Tyson has a bigger pay-per-view record, but the whole idea was in just like any invasion angle or any time a real world champion like Flair invades the WWF and has a whatever, the guy has to be presented as legitimate to get over. And that's what Dickhead couldn't understand.
Just I don't know if you realize this, but the jump on the part where you talk about Mike Tyson, at one point that there was an article that was done that it had Tyson versus Severn. Who would prevail? And it was written by a bunch of boxing experts, and I come out on the short end of the stick of this.
Oh, you said, but you know who won the pony with the boxing experts?
Okay. Yeah. But my when they came to me and really asked me, I could care less what you guys say. My only question is this: does Mike Tyson fight for the money, kind of money that Dan Severn is used to? Or does Dan Severn get to fight for the same kind of money that Mike Tyson is used to? Because if Dan Severn gets a chance to fight for Mike Tyson money, I will allow ear biting and whole nine yards, and I will walk away with both of his ears and destroy him, because that's called motivation.
Yeah, I've never understood how that the pay gets structured so much differently in these very similar sports, which are name-driven, star-driven. Anyway, but the point is, I think that your early success in the UFC came because you were probably the most disciplined guy when it was the Wild West, and all these guys were either one-dimensional or potentially just crazy.
I tell you, right.
You're able to be the most disciplined guy and the most prepared guy, and something about talent comes into it also, as well as conditioning and the longevity. Your lack of bad habits has enabled you to coach or train or compete or excel at a high level for 40 years or so. When you look at today's UFC or mixed martial arts in general with 47 rules and et cetera, is it the same way as when me and Brian last look at today's wrestling and there's the guys doing the choreographed gymnastics routine? Do you miss the old days? Is it the same for you, you know, as it is for us sometimes?
No, Jim, I never watched the product in the first place. That's kind of my part. It was just a friend of mine that watched the first two UFCs. He copied them on an old VHS tape and showed it to me. Now, you just got to realize, when pay-per-view first started up, it wasn't like all areas were available to see pay-per-view. You could go to a state like Michigan, and the pay-per-view might be available in the greater Detroit metropolitan area. It might be a lot in the Lansing area. It just a few of these major areas where, you know, these outlying cities like Coldwater, Michigan, did not get those kind of pay-per-views. Today, you can have pay-per-view that will pop up everywhere, including on your laptop, your iPhone. You can watch it anywhere at any time. You can watch this kind of stuff. So that was my first exposure of actually seeing this. I when I first saw it, it actually kind of shocked me. I'm thinking, you can actually do this type of competition in the United States. It was mind-boggling. But I filled out the application. When I showed up to my very first UFC, now you realize I always tell people what really separates me from any of the other competitors. First off, my age alone, I was an age-defying barrier. I've done that in a few different industries. I think even at the time that I signed with the WWF, I was the oldest rookie ever at 48 years of age. Because that's what Jim Ross had said. Because when the papers had been signed and I'm in the office with Ross and I'm with Vince and stuff like this, we're kind of, shaking their hands and slapping them on the back and the yuck yucks were going on around and stuff like this. So a few different questions. All of a sudden, Vince says, well, how old exactly are you? And I told him, and he looks over at Ross and goes, who's the oldest guy that's ever been on a roster? And Jim just points at me and goes, Dan is. But I mean, I don't look my age, nor do I act my age. From some things you say that, of life choices. I mean, I've already outlived, I think, probably 5 or 6 of my cage fighting opponents and probably close to 30 of my professional wrestling partners, and none of them were older than I am. But it just there's just certain industries that, you know, the pains, the pain pills, the injuries, and just extracurricular activities kind of take their tolls a little bit. I always tell people that, you know, none of us is getting out of the game of life alive. It's just how long are you going to stick around and how much fun did you have along the way?
Well, also, part of it is you're a freaky genetic fucker. I don't know how. And I will say you were kind enough, and let me just say that you were kind enough to come and help us out with a Ring of Honor show about 3 years ago. And by the way, some people were like, I was trying to do my part to get Severn and Shamrock on pay-per-view somehow for the third time, even in corners. I called you, and you readily accepted to be part of a world title match we were having with Davey Richards and Eddie Edwards, and I talked to Ken. And Ken said he was interested, but he had some guy, and I love you for this, you do your own business, because he had a guy booking him. And I talked to this guy and pitched him the deal. He said, let me get back to you, and I never heard back from him and couldn't get a response from him again. To the point, I think it was like 2 weeks after the match finally took place, he emailed me back, hey, are you still interested in having – I've been held up. And I'm like, no, it's already happened. But anyway – it would have been great to, and that's some people said, well, why is Dan Severn involved? Because he was blah, blah, blah. Why they could have brought these two independent guys in from Canada and had a 4-star match. I just want to let everybody know out there as a friendly, helpful hint to future promoters. If you think that when a television broadcasting company has just bought a wrestling promotion and has launched it on television in 60 of their markets and is having a big event in the middle of New York City at the Hammerstein Ballroom, it is preferable to have two outlaw guys from Canada have a 4-star match than it is to have a UFC Hall of Famer lend his credibility to your world championship match. Please don't ever promote anything. I'm begging you not to. Save yourself some misery.
No, probably.
But anyway, you were kind enough to come in and lend some credibility to those guys who we were selling an athletic, hard-hitting, competitive style of pro wrestling in the ring. We were trying to be different because that's something that doesn't get sold a lot these days.
Yep, I agree.
What did you think of the Ring of Honor matches? I mean, and once again, wrestling has changed even more than mixed martial arts has. If you had a style of pro wrestling that you would prefer to see presented and successful, what would it be?
I prefer the more strong style type of wrestling, but that's, you know, because that's kind of the wheelhouse that I come from. But to me, you know, there's all types of aspects of professional wrestling that I'm okay with. It just depends. What is the ultimate goal? Who are you playing to? That's going to put people's butts in the seats. That's going to make it entertaining. I think I enjoy probably the most was that era of the bigger than life characters. You know, when you had Sergeant Slaughter versus the Iron Sheik, and you know that was at the height of times. It was just so easy. You got the characters of a Jim Duggan who's got the 2x4. He's putting the wave in the middle, like oh. I mean, you had some great characters that made the shows entertaining to watch. You had, you know, heels, these villainous guys that are going against these good guys, and then back and forth, and you know, someone slides in there. Double teams attacks, and you know, another face slides in there, runs them on off, and now they unite as a tag team. And there were some very simple storylines that used to be told that, you know,
it wasn't that complicated. It, it, Exactly. It wasn't overproduced and overmanaged and over, you know, those guys could. But, you know, I actually sometimes almost think we're being too hard on the modern generation, because where are you going to find another Jim Duggan and another Iron Sheik? Do they make them anymore? If they would probably be locked up in a state home by the time they were 18 to 21 years old.
Well, I always say that sooner or later, as one gets older and the bench stuff that sits in, they might actually start living that gimmick life. You know, out there, they might be in a wheelchair trying to clothesline each other, you know, zipping up some speed, going on down, clothesline people or something like that. Or I just, I don't know. It's entertaining. As I said, even when I was first on board with the WWF, it was a great period of time, because it was during that attitude era where WCW was kicking the pants off of WWF each week, week in, week out. But it made Vince push the product more. It made athletes want to do more, so that they, you know, WCW has Goldberg and WWF comes back with Gilbert. I mean, just stuff like this, and the spoofs that they did, I thought were fantastic. I thought at the time.
And actually, Dwayne Gill is still getting, I saw him at Legends of the Ring, he's still getting booked off that incredible run and still brings his sparklers to the, have you watched any New Japan on Access since Jim Ross and Josh Barnett have started doing the commentary? You're so much like me. Hey, it's either with you, it could either be because it's too technological to do these things, or elsewise you just don't have time to watch TV. I watch a lot more TV than you do. I know that. You're too active.
I only watch a token program here or there. I always tell people that I am living life right now. Here's a cliche for you there, Jim. I always say that there's two types of people. There are those that are going to sit on the sidelines and watch life pass them by, and there are those that are going to engage the game. And because of the list of goals, I've always been I'm like that little soldier, that Boy Scout. I've always had a plan. And my biggest problem is I'm starting to realize I'm running out of time. Not that I think I'm going to die anytime soon, because I'm still banking on a buck and a quarter. And at a buck and a quarter, I'm hoping to die at the hands of a jealous husband, is what I'm hoping for. You know, a man's got to have a dream now. She'll be a much younger woman. She'll be in bed in her 90s, but I just couldn't help myself with those orthodontic stockings she was putting on there. But
they come in a variety of colors, yes.
Yeah. But I enjoy what I do. I have all along. I when people say, "What do you do?" I say, "I've been doing the same thing that I've been doing since probably my junior year in high school." I lived out of a planner then, because my summers were taken up wrestling and traveling around and going to this tournament, going to that tournament, making this national team, going abroad and doing this. I lived a superstar type style, even in my last couple of years in high school. And then to go into college, it opened up more doors, more opportunities. And when the cage, the first 92, when that professional wrestling first came to play, you know, that opened up, I'll say, kind of a Pandora's box in a couple of different ways. Because first off, I was shocked to see the paydays on the independent stages. I thought, oh my God, you got to be kidding me. I did all this stuff for 15 bucks. And then it's kind of like going, and then I see this tough man flyer. Hell, I never balled up my fist against my fellow man, but it's kind of like first prize was $1,000. I walked in there, destroyed seven men, and walked out of there with seven, with $1,000. I mean, that cliche necessity is a mother invention. I go, nope. Necessity was the father of invention. Here I am. I'm a young guy. I'm married. I've got a couple of children. I moved to Coldwater, Michigan for a job, and I did not have a job. I had to keep a roof over the table, food on the table, roof over the heads, food on the table. And even when I'd be traveling, people would be looking at me like, going, are you like a football player or something like this? I go, well, no. And they're like, well, what do you do for work? I go, well, I make money the old-fashioned way. And I go, how's that? Well, I beat people up and take it. And and they look at me like, they're confused. I go, what? And I go, but I say it so nice and calmly. They're like, I go, but you're okay. I go, my Prozac will last for another 45 minutes, and the flight's 2 hours long, you know? And then I go, well, you can see me get a little twitchy, and I just, I'm going to take a nap now. I enjoyed working them just a little bit because they just didn't know where I was coming from.
And since you do never slow down, before we go, we got to get your plugs in, because you got to tell the people, first of all, where, if they want to come to Coldwater and train, how do they find out about the sports camps? Where do they get the book? Where do they find your website? All that good stuff.
Well, I tell you, it should be going to dansevern.com. That's the website, and literally that is all the different ways of knowing what all my social media is, what the Facebook is, what the Twitter is. Just go to dansevern.com. We'll answer it all, and that's where all that stuff, because like you said earlier, Jim, I am a little bit technologically inept.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I was just going to, that's what I do. I just go to jimcornette.com, and that way I don't have to remember the stuff. Either that, or I have to carry a piece of paper around and read it verbatim.
Yes, exactly. I just say it's all there, and all the stuff about the book. Because it's, you know, the name, The Realest Guy in the Room, is what Ian Douglas, because after he started conducting this series of, read some of the different pages, and he's kind of blown away, because he was like going, he goes, Leipzig against Germany. I go, wait. What do you mean? I go, well, I said, well, Ian, I've been around a long time. I was wrestling during the Cold War. He goes, what? You know, because I even had a German media group that contacted me probably 6 or 8 months ago. And, you know, and they're talking about all the travels I've done. So I said, well, have you ever been to Germany? And I'm like, well, no. I said, I've been to West Germany. I've been to East Germany. But I have not been to just Germany. And even they were like, oh, what do you mean by that? And I was, well, I said, I was competing during the Cold War time period. I said, yeah, we, as Americans, we flew into the West, and then by bus, we went to the Iron Curtain border. We had to be, get off the bus. We had to produce all of our passport papers, things of that nature, allowed them to pass through the Iron Curtain, and then to proceed to Leipzig, East Germany. So I've said, I always tell people, I've seen the Iron Curtain. I've seen the Berlin Wall when it was in effect, not just on one occasion, but on three different occasions. So it's been an educational career as well, just to see and interact with people from all countries. And literally, you know, I might be going off on a little bit of a tangent. All people get along just fine. It's when our governments get involved that they tend to just, with their propaganda spin.
They need to keep everybody split. Each other. Yeah, they need to keep everybody against each other. But you cross the Iron Curtain when it's nerve wracking for me, and I even have problems. Go to Canada. You cross the Iron Curtain on a butt like you're fucking Hogan's Heroes. That's great. No,
well, the story about the Russians negotiations, lots of vodka. You had to have papers in order to leave your hotel room to get across, and yet the 198 pounder and I. We made it across that city, and we were doing the Russian negotiations, and it's a great story. And all I could say is, USA prevailed.
Hey, Dan, thank you very much. The book is The Realest Guy in the Room. The website is dansevern.com. Michigan Sports Camps is in Coldwater. You can train people to put a ham sandwich on their back and starve them to death. And before we go, before we leave the show, this weekend, Brock Lesnar and Mark Hunt, do you even know enough to make a prediction, or are you going to sit this one out?
No. I mean, that's probably the only match on there that I really could say anything about whatsoever. It's, you got two people, Brock Lesnar's kind of being on loan from the WWE to do at least one more match here in the UFC. It's, I guess, unprecedented. What it's already a sellout, and I think they're looking at possibly breaking some pay-per-view records. You know, on some of the negative side, you know, that Mark Hunt has to be tested, and yet they're giving Brock a wave. And I'm thinking, you know, just getting the similarities between Brock and I is that they've been touting him as being the first crossover professional wrestler, cage fighter, back and forth, amateur wrestling. I'm thinking, well, I did that almost 15 to 20 years before him with the NWA belt. That this upcoming fight for Brock, while I was under contract, I had a non-exclusive rights with the WWF. So I could travel and do and work for anybody I wanted to. I was still doing fights, state of nature. So in 1 year, while I was still underneath the contract with the WWE, I did 8 fights in 1 year alone and went undefeated. Brock Lesnar has had 8 fights so far in his entire career.
Well, you know, he had that problem for a couple of years with, well, I've got diverticulitis, but he wasn't wrestling at that point because he got tired of the wrestling business. I think the boy needs to commit. The boy needs to commit to something and stick to it. He's the most highest paid part-time fighter wrestler in the history of the world. Maybe Kevin Nash may be worse.
Oh, it's working for him. Either way, it's working for him. But other people have to agree to the deal. But I can't complain. You know, throughout my career, as far as I'm concerned, I made the best money at the times. But what did an NFL player make 20 years ago? Same way, what did a hockey player make? I made the best money at the time. But it's kind of going out. Well, I just want people to realize, you know, I have no future politics. If people ask me my opinion, well, I tend to rub their nose in the opinion right there. And that's kind of like where the title comes up, Dan Severn, the realest guy in the room. Because I don't sugarcoat nothing. I tell it like it is.
And as a matter of fact, I can vouch for that also because I have read an advanced copy of the book, although Ian has yet to send me something on paper. I'm sure he's going to rectify that shortly. And until then, once again, DanSevern.com for everything related to Dan Severn, JimCornette.com for everything related to Jim Cornette. And for our producer, Styles Bitchley, and my co-host, the great Brian Last, who has been immersed in this conversation. Ladies and gentlemen, I am Jim Cornette. And until next week, Dan, thank you very much for being a part of this,
thanks
for being
for
a guest on
me.
The program today. And buy the book, everybody. And we will see you folks next week on The Experience.
This is the MLW Radio Network.